ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Tammy Shipley believed someone was out to hurt her.
I thought someone was after me and I wanted to just be safe.
She's put under 24-hour surveillance.
I tried to get in contact multiple times.
I just need to make a phone call. Nobody knows where I am.
And then something strange happens.
She just drank and drank and had something like 20 litres of pure water.
Ambulance emergency.
I've got a woman unconscious.
Tammy's story. Search Background Briefing on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
From heart attacks.
If you're a woman in Australia and you present to an emergency department and you're having a heart attack, you're half as likely to be diagnosed as a man and you're twice as likely to be dead in 6 months.
To childbirth.
We are more likely to die
during childbirth.
Our children are more likely to have poorer health outcomes as well. And as I said, right from the get-go, you are categorised as an Aboriginal woman.
Today on Big Ideas, extraordinary stories of medical misogyny from GP appointments and hospital procedures to medical research and clinical trials, how women's health has been dismissed, diminished, even misdiagnosed, and how the healthcare system is finally, slowly changing. Hey, Natasha Mitchell bringing you Big Ideas, your front row seat to big thinkers at the very best live events. It's a big stage today at the Sydney Opera House on Gadigal Country for the 2026 All About Women Festival. Dr. Zoe Wainer is the inaugural Director General of the Australian Centre for Disease Control. She's a cardiothoracic surgeon by training who is Deputy Secretary in the Victorian Health Department. Conducted Australia's first ever public inquiry into women's pain. Yorta Yorta woman Summer May Finlay is an Associate Professor in Indigenous Health at the University of Wollongong. And asking the questions today is Deputy Editor of Guardian Australia, Gabrielle Jackson, author of the book Pain and Prejudice, How the Medical System Ignores Women and What We Can Do About It.
So let's start at the very beginning. Zoe, what is medical misogyny?
It's a broad and complex concept, but really we're looking at both conscious and unconscious bias against women in health and medical research. We see this throughout the entire pipeline, right from what we call laboratory or basic research all the way through to clinical medicine, where women are either forgotten, ignored, assumed that they're smaller men. And the consequence is that we have poorer outcomes often, or where our pain is dismissed or neglected.
And Summer, can you tell us a bit about what you understand medical misogyny to be and the unique ways that that affects First Nations women?
I don't really have much to add to that fantastic description, so I'll focus on Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women. So again, not only are women excluded, but Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are even less likely to be involved, particularly in, let's say, clinical trials. We know that our experiences are not included in research generally, unless it is specifically focused on Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. And then when our research is, when we are included in research, we are actually often just part of the number. So our unique experiences, histories, aren't always actually explored or understood particularly well. And what that means for our mob is that we often don't necessarily receive care in a way that is appropriate, or the results or outcomes of that research don't reflect the needs of our communities.
When I write about this, I often get lots of messages from men saying, "What are you talking about? Women live longer than men. How can this be an issue?" What do you say to that, Zoe?
They do, but women often live in poorer health than men do. I had an experience when I was a junior doctor of presenting a New England Journal paper, which is of course a very prestigious journal, to a cardiology team. And it was outlining what we've known for a long time and continues to be an issue, which is that women, when they present to an emergency department, are less likely to be diagnosed with a cardiac event. Once they are diagnosed, they take longer to get to treatment and they often have worse outcomes. When I presented this article, there was furious agreement amongst the cardiologists that they didn't treat their femoral patients any differently, which is, of course, actually the problem. But the professor of the unit said, "Look, it's an interesting study, but we can't be expected to undertake research into all minority groups." So So what was probably not the last career-ending move I've made in my life, I quietly pointed out to him that 51% of the population was not a minority, and yes, we do need to understand priority populations. But actually, at the heart of it, it's not just about women. It's about understanding the difference between women and men as well. There are conditions that women have better outcomes or are more likely to be diagnosed with, such as osteoporosis. Men are less likely to be diagnosed or even tested for osteoporosis because it's seen as a female disease. So this is actually, it is an equity issue, but it's also about 100% of the population. Understanding that difference is really important as well. So equally, I would say to men, you know, you have mothers, sisters, daughters, that this is also part of your business from that perspective.
And Summer, obviously in the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander community in Australia, the health outcomes are worse for men and women.
Yes.
So what are the unique issues that you see are prevalent in trying to solve in terms of women's health?
I mean, we know health is complicated, right? So quite a large amount of the disparity is caused by a range of factors, such as what we call the social determinants. So all of the things that you experience that impact your health that aren't necessarily health-related, like levels of education, housing, etc. So there are those factors which are not necessarily within the scope of the medical space. But in addition to that, we often aren't getting diagnosed for cancers until much later, or we are experiencing other chronic conditions, such as diabetes, at four times the rate. So we have quite a large group of people that are using the healthcare system, or hopefully using the healthcare system, at higher rates and yet not necessarily experiencing the healthcare system in an appropriate way. So when we talk about healthcare, and again, there is obviously general racism in the healthcare system. Anyone who is a person of colour knows this, and it only takes one negative experience with for yourself or with your family to then treat every healthcare experience with extra care. As a very well-educated, articulate person who can advocate for myself, I have experienced racism in the healthcare system. I've experienced racism in the healthcare system as a woman when I was pregnant. So I was told that despite being 40 when I had my first baby and having gestational diabetes, which we're also more likely to get as Aboriginal women, that I would be high risk anyway because I was Aboriginal. That is a New South Wales health policy. We have racism built into the system. And it's even worse for women when you think about all of the negative experiences that women are experiencing in the healthcare system. It is compounded by racism. And this is why our mob get diagnosed later for things like cancer, because they just don't trust the healthcare system and don't turn up.
It's a real issue, isn't it, that kind of trust? And I think that we see it through a lot of women who have chronic diseases, and especially women in pain, start second-guessing themselves when they go to hospitals. Zoe, I first came across your work when I was researching for my book. My book did not end where it started. When I first started, I thought, I'll write a book about women's bodies because I thought that our lack of understanding about our bodies was the reason we were not seeking care and didn't understand what was happening to us. And then I realised at some stage that, like, nobody understood women's bodies, actually. Like, the whole of medicine just had never really studied it in any serious way. And I think that when I came across some of your work on heart attacks in women was a real light bulb moment. It was the moment when I thought, oh no, what I'm suspecting is real. So I wondered, this is a double question here. First, tell us how you got interested in sex and gender in health, and then tell us a little bit about that, the cardiac work that you've done.
Look, I was born into a household dedicated to social justice when it came to women's health. So my parents were pioneers in the 60s and 70s to legalise access to safe abortion. So that was a milieu into which I grew up and really remained deeply committed. And my mother also did a PhD as a social scientist looking at why rural female GPs can have such a challenging time in their workplace. So I was certainly primed for it. And then obviously I had that experience as an intern when I presented the article on cardiac, and started actually a PhD. I was training as a cardiothoracic surgeon, and I started a PhD looking at lung cancer. Started off a little bit like your book. It didn't end where it started. It started in genomics, and then I did a side study looking at what we call PET scans, which is a test for cancer. And there was a theory that the hotter the PET scan, the more malignant that the cancer was. And I split the study by sex, and what it showed that it was that it was highly prognostic in men and not at all in women. If you hadn't split it by sex, it would have just looked mildly prognostic, and you would have applied that finding to women and to men, and it would have had no value whatsoever in women. So I got really curious about what was going on here. And in my research and looking at the research itself, realised that in cell lines, which is the laboratory research where we start with research, we often don't know the sex of the cell. Every cell in your body has a complement of sex chromosomes that they code for many more things beyond reproduction. So we don't actually know the sex of the cell that we do the laboratory research on. Historically, we have used male animal models, even for female diseases, or we remove the ovaries of the female animal, because apparently the estrous cycle complicates the research. We don't then add it back in, so we actually don't know whether or not it does complicate it, and when they have added it back in, it suggests that it doesn't, and so that's a false belief, and it's not really been accurately tested either. We then take the results from the animals and we apply them to people. Historically, we didn't recruit as many women into clinical trials, and that was partly due to, you know, complications around medications for women who were pregnant when they had been in clinical trials. And that obviously leaves an invidious decision for doctors, because we don't know what these medications do in women or when women are pregnant. So the whole pipeline of research to clinical practice is actually prejudiced against women. They don't know what the results are. But the assumption, very much like my story about the cardiologist, is that women are just small men and we don't have to think about them. But in actual fact, we know our biology is fundamentally very, very different. So the cardiology element that you're referring to, there was a really interesting article in 2018, I think, in the Medical Journal of Australia, which crystallised what we've known for a long time, which is that if you're a woman in Australia and you present to an emergency department and you're having a heart attack, you're half as likely to be diagnosed as a man and you're twice as likely to be dead in 6 months. Now, that data's not new, and yet we have not seen any shift in the health system to address that. And that's just one example of this, where we see this unconscious or conscious bias in health.
Zoe, why hasn't it changed when, as you said, all doctors know that women experience heart attacks differently? They know, they must know by now that women are not getting the same treatment as men. Why won't they fix it?
That's a $64 million question. It comes down to unconscious and conscious bias, a lot of it. Some people are really shocked. Even in healthcare, they're shocked. We actually are not teaching our students, our nursing students, our pharmacy students, our medical students. When I went through medical school, when you learnt anatomy, it was male anatomy. You didn't learn on female anatomy. If you went and looked at the textbooks, they were all male anatomy. I had a colleague who was an anatomy teacher, and he actually had to go to use images from pornography because that was only the only thing he could find, actually, of genitalia. Now, I have to say, I've actually looked at recent anatomy books, and they are starting to include it. So when I started this work, people would look at me, and I would agree with them because I was a baby PhD student. What are you talking about, Zoe? You know, this isn't an issue. What I think, Gabrielle, we are changing it. I think we're having this conversation now. We've seen a significant increase in the conversations and the data that's coming forward. But we've got to start to look at our clinical guidelines. You know, I'm reassured that the NHMRC is looking at this, which is our major funding body for health and medical research. But really getting in at the ground level of educating the community as well as our health practitioners is critical in that change.
Can I just make a comment on the NHMRC? So, full disclosure, I have funding from the NHMRC, but one of the challenges we have as Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people is that there's very few Aboriginal people that have PhDs. There's probably about 800, right? First 50 were in theology, so there's not that many when you think about all the spaces people could be doing work in. And so the vast majority of people that are doing research that involves Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are non-Indigenous. And with that, they bring their own cultural bias, their own cultural lens. And so it's actually compounded. Not only are we not seeing research that's done well with women or focusing specifically on women's experiences, we're actually then not having Aboriginal women's experiences often done by an Aboriginal woman. And so when you are thinking about research and you're interpreting it, even numbers, right? People say numbers are impartial, but they're not. It's the way you actually interpret those numbers. And I'll give you an example. There is a Sydney University who published a paper talking about Investment in lifestyle choices, I don't like that term, but that's the term that they used, versus so prevention through lifestyle choices, interventions, or hospitalisation, which was more cost effective. So the math was appropriate and done well. But in their discussion, they said a defining factor of Aboriginal people is their poor lifestyle choices. So when you're actually getting non-Aboriginal people who know nothing about our communities, who have inherited biases in the work that they do and the way they view us, you're then going to have even poorer research on Aboriginal women.
So is that why you got into your line of work, Summer?
Oh, I'm just curious. It was either journalism or research, I think. But I mean, I grew up in a household where social justice was definitely a key to the work that my mum does. My mum works really locally in the community. I hate going to Coles with mum. Everyone knows her, right? You can't take so long. I'm like, I will go get a coffee and I will see you in an hour. Because everyone knows her in the community. She is really passionate about making better outcomes for people in the community. I get itchy feet, so I moved around. And also I'm a bit of a, as one of my colleagues would say, a bit of a bolshy black. So I figured I would use that to my advantage and to our community's advantage and actually speak up in spaces that other people can't. Because as someone who is fair-skinned, and yes, colorism still is a thing, who is well-educated and has licensed as an academic to almost say anything as long as it's, I have academic freedom. I use that privilege that I have because of my experience. And I'm going to say my mum was a cleaner. So she and my dad worked really hard to put their three Aboriginal children, through private schools so that we could have better lives. So my mum needs every joint in her body replaced, all because she wanted to make sure we had an opportunity. So I also have a responsibility to honour that commitment she made to me as a baby to make sure my life was better than what hers was growing up. So I really just kind of do it because I can't help myself. Anyway, I can see Sess over here, a friend of mine. I can't help, but actually if something is not right, I have to say something. So I got into academia because it allows me to build a foundation and to use my privilege to be able to create hopefully better lives for my two girls and other people's children, and then if their children, if they choose to have them.
And carrying on that social justice tradition to improve Aboriginal women's healthcare is Yorta Yorta Woman and University of Wollongong Associate Professor Summer May Finlay on ABC Radio National's Big Ideas with me, Natasha Mitchell. Hello. Summer is joining you from the stage of the Sydney Opera House and this year's All About Women Festival. For this conversation, unpicking, unravelling, exploring medical misogyny. Also with Director General of the Australian Centre for Disease Control, Dr. Zoe Wainer, and asking the questions is Deputy Editor of Guardian Australia, Gabrielle Jackson, author of the book Pain and Prejudice, How the Medical System Ignores Women and What We Can Do About It.
I want to go back to the clinical trials for a moment because I wrote something once about the lack of female animals in pre-clinical trials, and I actually had quite a flood of messages from research students saying how unfair it was that I was saying they should include the same number of female animals as male animals because they're mostly postgraduate students and they really don't have time to use both and then do the analysis on the differences.
Poor them. They're so hard done by those postgrad students.
If it was just one, I would have thought, you know, fine. But it was actually like five or six. I don't know if it was a campaign. But I wonder if we could just talk about why we should both include female animals and then analyse the results for sex and gender differences or sex differences in preclinical studies.
There's a brilliant woman called Professor Londa Scheibinger at Stanford University, and she was one of the people I found when I was doing my PhD and people were still looking at me like I was crazy talking about this topic, who was doing extraordinary research in it. And she came out to Australia and was asked a similar question, because I've had conversations with researchers who say it's too expensive. I have to double the number of animals, you know, in order to be able to disaggregate by sex and compare. She's just got a really simple answer to that. That's just bad science. Yeah. It's bad science. So if you want your science to be meaningful, then you have to have equal numbers and you have to have sufficient numbers to be able to disaggregate. A lot of research that you'll see includes sex, and a lot of researchers think they do include sex because they have sex in what they call the multivariate analysis. Sorry, geek out with me on stats for a second. What that does is it removes sex as a factor. in what you're testing. It doesn't disaggregate male and female and compare and see if there's a difference. So it's actually a worse outcome because it's acknowledging that may be a factor and then it's removing it. One of the barriers I experienced early on in my journey in the PhD, I listened to a very eminent clinician researcher in cancer, and he would do what they call xenotransplantation. So he would take the tumour out of a human, put it into an animal model to allow him to test. And I very naively asked him in a public forum, did he sex match? So did he take it out of a woman and put it into a female animal and the same for male? He completely humiliated me and said, don't be ridiculous. That wouldn't make any difference. What are you talking about? And he studied growth factors, right, which estrogen and testosterone are major growth factors outside of reproduction. But what occurred to me afterwards is one of the barriers. This person was eminent, extremely well recognised in the research they did, and I then just publicly questioned his entire research. Regretfully, he didn't see it as an opportunity because, of course, he has the data and he could go back and look at it. But I think that's one of our barriers, Gabrielle, where we have people who have really established careers in research and clinical practice and they haven't asked the question. It's certainly a barrier I experience. Some of you may have read, and if you haven't, you can look it up in the conversation. There's a really interesting article about hip replacements. So hip and knee joint replacements are designed on men's anatomy. And if you think about our pelvises, they have very different angles because they're designed to do very different functions. So women are twice as likely to have complications as men are because the devices are not designed for us. When I've asked orthopaedic surgeons about this, their response is, oh no, you just have to do the right operation, because they've never gone and looked at their data and they don't know the answers.
And I was going to say, and part of the systemic issue is when you've got people like this researcher, they will have other students underneath them, they will have postdocs, they will have colleagues, they'll be the one that are leading the research. And so their way of thinking, their way of operating is actually permeating the system across the board. And so you're then having people trained in a particular way, and it's not until someone actually risks their own neck like you've done and calls it out, asks the question, decides to do things differently. And that is very hard for a lot of people.
And when it comes to human clinical trials, women were not traditionally included. They are now. But last time I looked, it was still only about a third of people in clinical trials are women. Is that still the case today?
It's improving. It's definitely improving. And as I've said, since I started this journey, 2005, 2006, I've seen this conversation, you know, get huge momentum, and there is change and people are shifting. So it's improving, but I think it has to be mandatory really to ensure that you have equal numbers of both sex.
Are there any rules in Australia around including women in human clinical?
The NHMRC is really strong on their stance on this, and they've really lately stepped up to the plate to really make that something that researchers have to think about and be very conscious about, and if they're not going to include it, then, you know, justify why.
And Summer, we know that there is a bigger burden of disease on the Indigenous population in Australia. What do we know about how many Indigenous people are included in clinical trials?
Very few.
Is there any signs of improvement?
There's conversations around it. There is definitely movement. I mean, there's not a lot of Aboriginal people involved in research generally, unless it's Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander specific research. And in clinical trials, I've had a conversation with one particular researcher who reached out to me because they realised that the disease that they were actually studying was more likely to impact Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, and yet they weren't included in... They had none that currently in their study. And so they reached out to me because I used to be co-chair of the Aboriginal Health and Medical Research Council Ethics Committee. So that's the New South Wales Aboriginal Ethics Committee, and we do all research that involves Aboriginal people in health, to talk about how they could recruit. But the answers were not dissimilar to when you were talking about women being involved and female animals. It's just too hard. We're too small a population, we're dispersed. So in New South Wales, we're about 2% of the population. In Australia, we're just sitting under 4%. And so when you're trying to recruit people, and we also are much more likely to have chronic diseases, which often exclude us from clinical trials. Mm-hmm. So it requires a substantive investment and impact and focus on it. And most researchers don't do that, and some of it is in part because of their ignorance, I would say, and some of it is because the systems and structures are set up in a way that don't actually enable them to take the time to go out and effectively recruit.
It's just a bit too much effort, we keep hearing.
Yeah, but it starts at the top, and I have to say, again, the NHMRC can do better with this.
Yeah, they have been a bit slower than other countries in mandating the inclusion of female animals and human women in trials, haven't they?
Yeah, and look, even with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander, so there's ethical guidelines for research with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people that was released in 2018, and I was involved in writing those. And as the chair of an ethics committee, pretty sure most researchers probably hadn't read them. I actually resigned as chair of an ethics committee because I was sick of seeing crap research, and as the chair supporting crap research to become average research to then be able to get ethics approval. So I decided I'd use that energy and actually do good research with our mobs and our communities. And I do work in child and maternal health and lactation and supporting women to get good lactation support so they can breastfeed their babies. But yeah, the NHMRC is doing better than they were, but there's a lot of room for improvement.
So we've established that medicine knows a lot less about women's bodies and health than it does about men. But what does that mean when women go in to see their GP or they go into the emergency department? How does it kind of manifest for women?
So firstly, I'd like to say Australia has a really good health system.
We do.
But we do see unconscious and conscious bias with women. So when I was working in the Victorian government, we undertook an inquiry into women's pain. I think it's one of the world's first. We were expecting, I don't know, 1,500 responses. We got 13,000 women, girls and clinicians who responded to that with just heartbreaking stories. In fact, I was just catching up with a friend of mine last night who fell over in the dark, broke both her legs. She happened to be an elite athlete, had a very high pain tolerance, so she went to bed instead of calling an ambulance because she had two kids at home and no one else. I'm sure there's a whole other story. But when she finally got to hospital, they actually wouldn't give her pain relief because they thought there was drugs or alcohol involved. So they wanted to get social workers involved, child protection involved. And she was saying, could I just have some pain relief? Because she'd broken two bones in one leg, one bone in the other. And she was faced with all these hurdles of proving that she was legitimately there with broken legs to get pain relief before they actually gave it to her. And there are many stories out of the pain inquiry just like that.
Some of there is a particular issue for First Nations women in pain seeking medical treatment, isn't there?
Absolutely. So there is a perception amongst some health professionals that we have a higher pain tolerance. May or may not be true, but you know, a lot of, and I was reading a study that came out.
I think research has shown that, am I right?
Sorry, I mean for individual women.
Oh, yes, apologies. Right,
like,
okay.
You know, so we have a range of pain tolerances generally.
Yes.
Thank you. Don't mean to imply First Nations women have higher pain tolerance. I can tell you, I went through childbirth. I don't think my pain tolerance is that high.
Well, let's see if a man could go through it. And then.
Yeah, although, can I say, gallstones hurt more than childbirth, I realised. But anyway, there was a study that came out of Central Australia where they looked at pain relief that was given to Aboriginal women and the perceptions of health professionals around the need for pain relief. And what it came down to in that particular study was that culturally, Aboriginal women were being stoic. They weren't complaining. They weren't speaking up. There's a range of reasons why Aboriginal women don't do that. They don't trust the healthcare system. It may not be their first language. They may have had a negative experience. There are cultural factors around just, you know, not expressing in particular circumstances. And so they were not given appropriate levels of pain relief because they were perceived as not needing it, despite the fact that they clearly did.
Mm. And there's a whole other stereotype as well, isn't there? I covered an inquest into a tragic death of a young woman called Naomi Williams in Tumut, who had a chronic pain issue, and she had been to the emergency department 17 times and she was continually turned away. She was sent to drug and mental health services because they assumed she was a drug addict, and when she was coming to the emergency department, she was drug seeking. Twice that service sent her back and said, there's no drug or alcohol issue. She needs to see a specialist. She's in pain. And she was 6 months pregnant and went to the hospital with a fever and in a lot of pain. And they sent her home with two Panadol and she died of septicemia later that night. It was such a tragedy. but she couldn't be taken, her pain was not taken seriously. She was just written off as a drug addict.
And it's not an uncommon experience. I was doing some research into the cultural safety or in healthcare in New South Wales, and a woman who was part of that focus group that I was running, that my mum helped me organise, because she, as I said, she's a community broker and she, you know, she knows everyone. And so she was saying that that's what happens, and a whole bunch of other things. 2 weeks later, she went to hospital. She was feeling very unwell. She had diabetes and was sent away and told to take Panadol. Died that night because she had fluid building up in her lungs and around her heart. Two young children.
Isn't it a tragedy that we have two stories like this just from two people we've come across?
Yeah. You think about Ms. Du, who died. You know, there is a lot of stories about that. Panadol is essentially what is, when, yeah, they tell you to go and take Panadol, it's really essentially, why are you bothering us? And it happens more and more to Aboriginal people than I've seen.
Zoe, that pain inquiry has done a massive report and it had some recommendations. Were there any of the recommendations could solve some of these problems of people not being taken seriously?
Absolutely. And I mean, just to add to the stories, you know, I have an older relative who presented to the emergency woman who presented to the emergency department with crushing central chest pain radiating up to the jaw and down the left arm. Now, in medical school 101, that's a heart attack. She didn't test positive on any of the tests for heart disease or for having a heart attack, so she was sent home. They retested. She presented again with exactly the same symptoms, sent home. Eventually, they did an angiogram, and I think it's partly because I was an intern on their unit, so it would have been a bit embarrassing, really. And sure enough, she was having cardiac issues and she had a stentable lesion. If she'd been sent home one more time, she probably would have died, but she was being dismissed. And her pain was described, which fascinated me, as atypical. It was only atypical because she was female. That is typical cardiac pain. You know, another story of a woman who was in her 70s and presented to a GP with pain on intercourse. The GP's response was, "You're lucky to even be having sex at your age," and sent her home. And she had a burst appendix 2 weeks later with emergency surgery. These stories are everywhere. And again, it comes down to that conscious and unconscious bias issue.
I would call it willful ignorance. Yeah.
Are there any programs that are working that actually make doctors or nurses or the healthcare professionals stop and reconsider before they ignore these atypical symptoms?
Look, there's some fantastic work, obviously speaking to my previous role in Victoria in women's health, where obviously the inquiry itself, the publication, there's been quite a lot of media around that. So it's raising community awareness, but it's also raising awareness in clinicians. So we are seeing an increase in an understanding, but I think a long way to go.
And Summer, are there any programs that help Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people build trust in health systems so they do go and seek help when they need it?
Aboriginal health services.
Tell us about those.
So there's about 240 Aboriginal community-controlled health organisations around the country. So they're Aboriginal organisations, health organisations run by and for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. So they have a board that's made up of Aboriginal people, which are made up of members who are Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people from that community. And these are organisations and health services. And I call them organisations because they're primary health organisations, but they're comprehensive. They do things that aren't just considered to be in the health sphere. So they might have financial counselling, they might work with the justice system, they might have people that are lawyers in there doing a whole range of things with their clients. So these are organisations that really understand Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, because the people that manage them, govern them, are Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people themselves. The first one was set up just down the road here in Redfern. So that was the first ever Aboriginal medical service in this country. The second was the Victorian Aboriginal Health Service in Melbourne. And these services genuinely are doing and driving health outcomes, better our health outcomes for our mob. When it comes to women, we do have Waminda, which is on the south coast. They're an Aboriginal women's service. They're just opening up a number. They are going great guns. So they were set up by Aboriginal women when they realised they were not getting the healthcare they need, particularly around pregnancy and birth. So, and there's a number of missions down on the south coast, Nowra, and women were on those missions and they were banned from cultural practices, which included birthing practices. So they then had to go to the hospital, but often they were giving birth on the grass outside the hospital because, well, you can't have Aboriginal people in your hospital. So they were told that it was illegal to actually birth on country and privately, so they had to go up to the hospital. And again, they were having horrendous health outcomes. So now they actually have this beautiful community organisation that is doing birthing on country. So they got the legislation changed in New South Wales to allow continuity of care. So they would do shared care with their patients. And when they went up to the hospital, they actually had visiting privileges up at the hospital, the Aboriginal health worker and the primary healthcare staff. So they advocated to New South Wales to have the legislation changed so that they could actually go up to that there. They're building a residential drug and alcohol facility. They are, I can't even tell you, they have post-release services for Aboriginal women. They have so many amazing services, all because they saw an absolute need, because mainstream health services just weren't cutting the mustard, and they're still not.
Mm.
What a positive example from Summer May Finlay, who is an Associate Professor in Indigenous Health at the University of Wollongong. On ABC Radio National's Big Ideas, Natasha Mitchell joining you, and you're also hearing from Dr. Zoe Wainer, Director General of the Australian Centre for Disease Control, and the host from Guardian Australia, Gabrielle Jackson. They're exploring medical misogyny at this event at the All About Women Festival at the Sydney Opera House.
Well, I want to talk about what the outcomes were with this centre, but first I think there was a lot of publicity about maternal health outcomes in black women in America. I think Serena Williams's experience helped bring that really into the mainstream in a way that wasn't before. So do we know what Indigenous women's experiences are in maternal and child health outcomes in Australia?
We know that we are more likely to die
during childbirth.
Our children are more likely to have poorer health outcomes as well. And as I said, right from the get-go, you are categorised as an Aboriginal woman. So, and what that means as well, like I had a, like just for example, I had a complications during pregnancy, low-lying placenta, on my fifth bleed. I'd been up to hospital every time. It turned out fine, beautiful baby, no problems. But one of the obstetricians was almost not going to discharge me because he didn't think that I would return if I had another bleed. Even though it was my fifth bleed and I had been up to hospital every time, and I'm kind of like, are you not trusting me because I'm a woman? Are you not trusting me because I'm Aboriginal? So we know we have poorer health outcomes. You talk about cardiovascular disease. We have women that go up to hospital who are presenting much younger. My cousin at 45 died. I'm 45. She died at my age of a heart attack because we are presenting younger with cardiovascular disease, which is one of the biggest killers of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. But yes, we have about 10 years ago, and it has improved, but so has the outcomes for non-Aboriginal women. We had about the same child and maternal health outcomes in Aboriginal communities as Bangladesh.
Wow, when was that?
I think it was 2014, so just over 10 years ago.
And these birthing on country programs, have they improved outcomes?
Absolutely. Waminda is seeing better health outcomes. So, for example, because they're working with a service that is in their community that is run by and for Aboriginal women, if and when they do actually, if they are using substances during pregnancy, they're actually disclosing it. So we know that Aboriginal people are more likely to have their children removed or have fear of child removal because of previous experiences. And so they're actually, Aboriginal women have a greater trust in these services and are disclosing so that they then can get the support that they need. And I can tell you, again, I have a PhD, I own my own house, and I still was offered a social worker three times during my first antenatal appointment with a midwife. And I thought that was kind of weird. So I went and spoke to a few people, social work friends of mine, my GP, my cousin who's a midwife, and they all said, oh no, that's not normal. And so the only thing I can do is put it down to the fact is that I'm Aboriginal, which then made me nervous that I was going to be identified as someone who needed to be watched or monitored. And so you have women who are going in and disclosing. Because we know, again, one of the closing the gap targets is antenatal appointments in the first trimester. We know that if you go and actually see a health professional in the first trimester, you have better health outcomes for mum and bub. There's multitude of reasons why people weren't going in for their first antenatal appointment. But pretty much all of the women that knew they were pregnant early on, which is the vast majority, that go to that service on the South Coast, Waminda, are going in their first antenatal appointment and disclosing the things that would otherwise be difficult for them to disclose.
So we know that these programs work. Does that mean there are a lot of them and available to most Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women?
No. No. There are a few, and I have to say, to their credit, and possibly because they were about to get a bollocking with the recent Closing the Gap report targets, which only see four on track out of the 17 and three of them are going backwards. But they did actually, the federal government did actually invest more money in recently, I think it was like $44 million or something, in birthing on country programs.
Great. That's a bit of good news then.
Yes, yes.
Just in case you think it's just about how we're treated, I think it's important to point out the sexism goes much deeper and it's kind of embedded into our entire health system. Zoe, I wonder if you could explain what the Medicare benefit schedule is and how medical misogyny plays out in that.
Guessing a lot of people know what it is from that response to the question, but obviously the MBS, as we often term it, is the public insurance. So this is how doctors get reimbursed in our public system or in the private system, and there may be an out-of-pocket. When I was on the National Women's Health Advisory Council, one of the things that was brought to our attention was that there's a gender bias or a sex bias within the MBS. So if you ultrasound a single testicle, you get reimbursed more than if you ultrasound a woman pregnant with twins.
No.
So it doesn't take a medical degree to work out the complexity, but perhaps the value, I'm not sure. And we see this littered through a lot of the funding. So it's the same for a GP who will do an in-room vasectomy, which is a pretty straightforward procedure. I think the last time I looked, it was about $750 to put an IUD in, often without pain relief, is $75. Mm-hmm. So again, we're seeing this real disparity through our funding mechanisms as well.
Is there any work being done to fix that?
My understanding is yes. I'm not currently on the National Women's Health Advisory Council, but my understanding is yes, there is. Yeah, it's been identified and something that needs to be rectified.
If you could identify one urgent issue that you could fix if you had all the money in the world tomorrow, what would that be? I'm going to ask both of you. So
I got about 10.
Okay, we'll go for 10.
That I might have thought of before. Look, the first thing that we've sort of touched on, I think, is data. And data is so important because that's how we surface this. We've talked about multivariate analysis and how we kind of disappear sex as an issue. So I think ensuring that we disaggregate all of our data by sex, that we ensure that all of our animal models have male and female animal models. You know, the fact that there are people undertaking research into women's diseases on animals and they use male animal models, there's a cognitive dissonance there, isn't there? To think
I think the first study on estrogen and its effects on heart disease was done in men.
And I know some neuroscientists who use female animals only, and I don't think it's any more justifiable. They do it because they smell less and they're less likely to bite. But again, we actually need both sexes because this is about 100% of the population. It's not just about women. I think we actually need to look at our hospitals and our healthcare system and get agile teams in, going in clinical unit by clinical unit. We should have every hospital required to have, you know, a dedicated team looking at the differences in outcomes when it comes to women and men, and helping our clinicians understand why this matters. You know, my point about the orthopaedic surgeons is they often don't look at their data, so they don't think it's a problem until you actually have to look at it. And again, it takes female orthopaedic surgeons to see that there's a problem for women who are undergoing orthopaedic surgery. I think we need to work with communities and help them understand what's the challenges for them, not just, you know, from a bureaucrat in my position or a public servant, but actually what's the challenge on the ground the communities are experiencing with their healthcare. I touched on this before, education, but, you know, in our universities, but community education as well. But we still fail to disaggregate by sex in teaching our nursing students, our pharmacy students and our medical students. So we're re-embedding that unconscious bias with every generation. And I know there are some universities that are really starting to grapple with this. Charité in Berlin is a world leader, but I know there are Australian universities that are really wanting to look into this as well. Working with our colleges, you know, medical colleges, nursing colleges, pharmacy colleges, how do you actually build this into the vocational training pathways as well? And then I think also understanding patient and people's journeys and how do we bring that to the fore of a lot of this conversation. You know, we know those stories are incredibly powerful. Some have shared some, I've shared some. Those individual journeys actually are very confronting, I think, for healthcare workers and help them really think twice about their own unconscious bias. And I shared a story earlier about a colleague of mine who did his PhD in an area of cardiac, and women didn't have this problem. So he told me he didn't need to look at sex differences because only men have the problem. And I thought to myself, don't you want to know why women don't have the problem? Like, isn't there possibly a solution and an answer in that? So there's something about bringing it to the fore as well to really kind of trigger that curiosity, I think, as well.
So sum up, what's your...
Well, I think first and foremost, listen to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people and women in particular about the experiences that they have, like Zoe said. I do think education is important, but education has to be done in a way that is done differently. So the new medical teaching standards require about a third of their standards now relate to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, and quite unsurprisingly, the vast majority of medical departments within medical schools or faculties within universities are struggling to actually be able to achieve that. I think there needs to be a significant investment in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health workforce. Mm. We know that health is actually the largest employer of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, and a large number of those people are Aboriginal health workers, and they are fantastic, but a lot of them do Aboriginal health work, so that is a Cert 4. And there's two pathways. There's a clinical pathway and there is also a non-clinical pathway, community development. But they do that because that's all that's really available in their community. So we need to be making sure that we're working with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people to go into the health workforce and be skilled up to the best of their capabilities. And can I just say, also using Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people for their clinical skills if they do have them, rather than using them as cultural brokers, or in some cases where I've seen mainstream health services use the clinical Aboriginal health workers as nothing more than a glorified transport officer. The other thing I would say is that we need Aboriginal people within the hospitals to act as navigators or as advocates. Now, we do have Aboriginal liaison officers. They work between 9 and 5 because clearly Aboriginal people only get sick between 9 and 5. And often in a whole hospital, there's only one, maybe two. Now, when you think about that, people say, well, we're only a small proportion of the population. We're, you know, depending on where you're located, we might be 2% of the population. In Newcastle, we're 12% of the population. But our episodes of care, that is how many times we come in contact with the healthcare system, are often 2 to 3 times, sometimes 4 times greater than our population. So if you are having a quarter of your population that you're seeing, even if it's repeat people, coming into your hospital, you might want to start thinking about resourcing not on percentage but on episodes of care, but that doesn't happen. And what I really need is for every single person who works within the healthcare system to start challenging their own thinking, to really interrogate. When I had that obstetrician tell me that I would be high risk even if I didn't have gestational diabetes and wasn't having a baby at 40 because I was Aboriginal, I challenged her. And I know that's not everyone's ability as an Aboriginal person. You're very vulnerable in those circumstances. But I thought, F it, I'll take it on. You can take me on, I'll deal with it. Because I was just like, I can afford to pay to go and see a private obstetrician if I desperately need to. And I said to her, can you explain to me why clinically I am high risk beyond the factors we've identified? Look at the social factors. Look at my clinical factors. And she said to me, it's clearly more complicated than I originally thought. Literally sit there and interrogate and do your reading and think about it. It is not secret squirrel business that we are sicker. 24% of Aboriginal women live with a disability.
Yeah, there are higher numbers of disability in women in general, aren't there? And do we know why? Zoe? Simple question for you.
Yeah, simple question. Look, no, I don't. I can't really speak to that, Gabrielle. But yeah, I'm aware of the statistics.
You both just talked about listening to women. And I think we should be, you know, careful to say that I think that's a whole society problem. That's not a medical problem.
It's because we're a minority. It's hard to listen to a minority.
but I think that comes to all women, and also in particular First Nations women who are going through healthcare episodes.
And can I just say with the listening as well, you tend to only be listened to if you're not hysterical, right? And I'm obviously don't believe women are hysterical. But then when you've got the additional layer of racism on top of it, you can't be the angry black. Mm. You can't be someone who is challenging the healthcare system. because you are more likely to be thrown out, because Aboriginal people are seen as more likely to perpetrate violence. So therefore, if you do actually, so we have to at all times be really performative in the way we engage with the healthcare system.
So what is your advice then? It's a really tricky situation to not advocate too much. What do you do if you feel like you're in a situation where you're not being taken seriously because you're a woman or you're an Aboriginal woman? What do you do?
You often die or you leave and you get sicker. But in reality, what that means is that if, as a healthcare professional, when you're hearing someone who is clearly distressed, whose anxiety is up because it's their health or their child's health or a person that they're actually there supporting's health, they really just need to check their egos.
Zoe, do you have any advice for women who feel like they're not being taken seriously?
I mean, I think Summer's points are really valid, being as much as you can, understanding and advocating for yourself. But I really think it's a system issue and we need to think of it at that level, because advocacy puts a responsibility back on the individual and off the system. And I think we've got enough examples to say that this is a systemic issue. So that's why it's on people like you and I to keep raising it in the forums that we have the opportunity to.
And the only reason I'd say is individuals make up the system, though. So every individual in the system has a responsibility.
I do like to end on a note of hope. And I think in the past 10 years, we have seen a dramatic difference, especially in terms of endometriosis. Like when I first started writing about it, some of our health editors hadn't even heard the word. And we've had a huge increase in funding as a result. So I'll just ask you both, do you have a reason to hope?
Absolutely, absolutely. When I started this journey for myself, as I said, it was around 2005, 2006, people would look at me like I was crazy. Like, quite literally, it was only when I found Professor Londa Scheibinger and Professor Cara Tannenbaum, who's in Canada, and Canada is a leader in the space, that I was like, oh my goodness, this is not, I'm not just imagining this kind of complete gap. So I have seen a huge momentum. You know, we've had the National Women's Health Advisory Council. We've seen significant investment specifically into women's health. So I have great optimism, but I think there's a fair way to go as well.
Let's end on Summer's hope.
Look, to be quite honest with you, the mere fact that as an Aboriginal woman, I can sit here and actually be on this stage demonstrates there is hope for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women to be able to really advocate for on behalf of our communities. We have some fabulous Aboriginal women in healthcare, some who are retiring. So one of the biggest champions of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health in particular is Pat, Auntie Pat, who's just retiring and stepping down from the National Aboriginal Community Controlled Health Organisation. She has driven the Closing the Gap agenda over the last... She absolutely... Oh, honestly, formidable woman. Don't want to get on a bad side, but formidable woman. So for me, I just think that the fact that we're having these conversations, the fact that you're here listening to them, and the fact that you've got people like me who can sit here and are invited to sit here, demonstrate there is change.
Well, thank you very much.
Can I just jump in with one last thing? Also to thank you, because it's people like you and people in roles that you're in that actually, you know, highlights this issue through the media, and it's incredibly powerful. So just a thanks to you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you, everyone.
Incremental change, but heading in the right direction. Gabrielle Jackson, Deputy Editor of Guardian Australia and author of Pain and Prejudice, How the Medical System Ignores Women and What Can Be Done About It, was hosting that session at the All About Women Festival at the Sydney Opera House. Big thanks to the Opera House team. You heard from the Director General of the Australian Centre for Disease Control, Dr. Zoe Wainer, and University of Wollongong Associate Professor in Indigenous Health, Summer May Finlay. And I'm Natasha Mitchell. You can email the show, bigideas@abc.net.au. Love hearing from you. Thanks for listening. I'll be back next time. Bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.